John chapter 3. So now we're beginning, Lance. 1 John chapter 3. This is part 2. I told you last time, because I'm afraid that some of you might read things that I read, that much of my thoughts from what I'm sharing with you, if you want to call it sharing, I got from Jonathan Edwards in a sermon he preached. Actually, it was a little bit lengthier than a sermon on the dying love of Christ. And I thought, this is so insightful. It's biblical. I'll try to put it together and make it look like my own and hide it from you. But I decided I'll just admit that I got a lot of these thoughts from Jonathan Edwards. It is my own title, The Incomparable Dying Love of Christ. 1 John 3 says, "See how great a love the Father has bestowed on us, that we would be called children of God, and such we are. For this reason the world does not know us, because it did not know Him. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not appeared as yet what we will be. We know that when He appears, we will be like Him, because we will see Him just as He is. And everyone who has this hope fixed on Him purifies himself just as He is pure. See how great a love the Father has bestowed on us." The little phrase, "how great a love," it's a little particle, a little word that comes from a root word that means of what country? Patimos. Of what country? Or of what manner? That's why I think the King James translates it, "what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us." John is saying is this: the love of God towards His people, towards sinners, is a love that's of another country. It's foreign. It's unknown. It's unheard of. Of what manner is it? What kind? For example, when the angel came to Mary and told her that she would bear Christ, the angel said, "Greetings, favored one, the Lord is with you." And she said, "What manner of salutation is this? What kind is this? That this is foreign to me. This is like of another country. What is this?" She didn't know what it meant. She'd never heard such a salutation addressed to her. It was foreign to her. Same word here. And when Jesus calmed the sea and the storm, the disciples said, "What kind of man is this? What unheard of, unknown man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him?" Well, John says, what kind of love is this? What kind of unheard of, unknown love is this? And of course, the whole book of 1 John unfolds it, and he centers on the dying love of Christ. Verse 9 and 10 of chapter 4. "By this the love of God was manifested in us, that God has sent His only begotten Son," 4:9, "into the world so that we might live through Him. And this is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us." That's the foreign quality to it. What kind of love is this? And you'd have to understand, and we will attempt to understand, what He means by "loved us and sent His Son." And here's the dying love, to die, punished in our place as a sacrifice, to purchase pardon, to be a propitiation, He says, to be a propitiation for our sins. Now, last time, about a month ago, last communion, we looked at this subject of the incomparable dying love of Christ and saw that it's incomparable because there's no comparison in the fact that the objects that He loved are infinitely lower than Him. And there's no one else that's ever loved an object so further beneath them than He has. There's no other parallel. You ever notice that Hollywood stars marry Hollywood stars? Rock stars marry rock stars. Business magnates marry supermodels. And then there's you and I. See, we're too far beneath them. That's true. I'm not saying that critically. There's as it were, a proportion to our love. His love is incomparable in that the objects of his love are infinitely further beneath them than any other lover has ever chosen to love. And we looked at that last time. He's infinite in his majesty. He's without beginning. He's eternal. He's sovereign. He controls everything. We're not a speck on the scales to him. Yet he chose to love us. But it's incomparable. Because the objects that he loves are infinitely incapable to the greatest degree of ever benefiting the lover, the one who loves them. The objects of his love, that's us, have an incapacity to benefit him that's greater than anyone that's ever been loved. We have no capacity to benefit him. And usually people love the objects that they love because there's some contribution, some benefit. There's some lack to their happiness. There's some need. It's not good for Adam to be made alone. I'll make a helpmate for him. There's always some kind of influence in the object love that will reciprocate back and add to the lover. We are objects of his love who are completely, infinitely incapable beyond any degree of benefiting him. For he has no lack. He's entirely sufficient. He's entirely contented and happy in himself. So there's just no love like this. You understand? There is no love like this. There is none. Now tonight we want to see something else that makes it incomparable. The iniquity, the deformity, and the lovelessness of the objects of love are the greatest beyond any in comparison with which someone has ever given love to. There's never been objects whose deformity and lovelessness is as great as ours in proportion to the one who loves us. So John said, what kind of love is this? It's from another country. Never has so little been in an object to draw out love. You know, natural affections will enable parents to love their children when they're totally undeserving, unworthy, and ungrateful. Because there's a bond. They're their children. That isn't there with fallen man. There's nothing in the object to draw it out. Now go to Romans chapter 5. This is where we started last time. And notice Paul in 5 and 6. Chapter 5 of Romans, verse 6 and 7. Paul talks about this very unparalleled, incomparable love, dying love of Christ for sinners. Right there in 6 and 7. While we were still helpless at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for a good one, man, someone would dare to die. In human relations, that's as far as you can go. A righteous man, someone who simply does what's right and just, doesn't necessarily do it to benefit you or bless you, no one would never die for that person. But if there's a good man, someone who's done good for you, blessed you and benefited you, then perhaps you'd die for them. And that's as far as it'll go. I mean, that's noble. This is beyond that. Because the objects of love have an iniquity in them, a deformity to them, and a lovelessness about them that's beyond any object that any lover has ever loved. He describes it in eight. We are sinners. And of course, in the Bible, sinners is rebellious, willful, defiant, disregard. Described in 10, as we were enemies, we were reconciled to God. Edward says, men have no idea of any such thing as being in love with those in whom they see nothing in the object to excite their love. In other words, it's not in our thinking. It's not even a category. We have no concept, no idea, he says, of any such thing as being in love with those in whom we see nothing in them to excite us to love them. It's not even a category. There has to be something in them. It's not even a category. Now, man is positively an abhorrence, an object of deformity to God. He has a corrupt nature. Look at Ephesians 2. He has a corrupt nature. His nature is polluted. It's bent to perversity. It's bent to doing perverse things, to being cruel, to being unkind. And it's bent to rebellion and defiance and ingratitude and arrogance in the midst of it all. You were dead in your trespasses and sins in which you were formerly walked or lived according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that's now working in the sons of disobedience. Among them, we too all formerly lived in the lust of our flesh. We just gave ourselves over to our desires in whatever form or area that we released it in. To some people, they've not got the courage socially to go be scandalous, but they release their desires and their lusts in some area of revenge and bitterness. And they just don't hold back anymore. It's unrestrained, he says, and every one of us has an area like that. Indulging in the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. We aroused indignation in God. Our natures were polluted. It's, as it were, deformed. They aren't what they ought to be. They're not naturally grateful. His sun shines on the just and the unjust, and very few give him thanks. It's like the 10 lepers that were healed, only one came back to say thank you. And he came back to say thank you because God's sovereign grace in his heart. I mean, we see it in our children, parents. See, when is this child ever going to be grateful? Correct? And sometimes that arouses more ire in a parent than outright rebellion. You got to be a parent first. And that's all the parent's comfort, is that our kids will be a parent someday. Some of us won't live to see that, but... And there's a deformity to our nature that arouses indignation, or what he calls wrath. And there's an arrogance with it, because most of us don't agree that it should arouse that in him. We don't even think it should. We tend to see him in a negative light, that he would even respond to us that way, because we don't even see it. So there's this unparalleled deformity, this infinite deformity. Edwards commented on this. He said it like this. Fallen man is destitute of all that was lovely. So therefore, he's full of all deformity. There is a filthy, a beastly, and a devilish nature that reigns in the hearts of natural men. Jesus Christ, when he passed by us, saw us loathsome and naked. He might justly have turned away from us with abhorrence, have left us in our filth, stood at a distance from us as abominating to have anything to do with them who were so filthy. But it was otherwise. The time was a time of love. Instead of the lovely image of God, there was the foul image of Satan that appeared on us. Corruption was our nature. that was more odious in the eyes of Christ than the nature of a toad or a serpent is to us. Natural men are like vipers. Their poison is as the poison of a serpent and as the venom of asp. Men by sin became like a pig that delights in the wallow in the mire. They're like a filthy worm that never feeds so sweetly as when feeding on carrion, and never has its nature so suited as when crawling in the most abominable filth. And if you ever think about it, isn't that us? You watch a young child that's 12 or 13, and it begins to find out about sin, and it revels in it and delights in it. It swims in it, and it begins to master it and practice it. That's the story of most youths. It delights in the filth. It swims in it. It's amazing. Think about it. That's most youths. And then they begin to brag about the sin they've done. It's abominable if you think about it. If your head's on straight, which only gets on straight by the workings of God in regeneration, you can see that's perverse. That's deformity. He should have passed by, but it was a time for love. Amazing. I love the way he says that. It was a time for love. Isn't that most youths and lives? Becoming skillful at evil. It's true. And going further and further at it. And then boasting. And then that doesn't mention the rebellion against God. In fallen man, for whom Christ died, there was predominated all sensual and earthly dispositions, a nature prone to sensual impurity, a debased nature, and yet a most abominable pride and haughtiness of spirit with it, an inclinedness to be unjust and to those things that are in themselves most unreasonable. Christ saw all this deformity that was in their hearts, and he set his love on them. Now you please tell me where else you find love like that. It's amazing, isn't it? It's just nowhere else. You put your hands and your life into his care and you'll be well taken care of. You'll be well taken care of. Now, so there's an iniquity and a deformity of lovelessness and it's that's greatest. There is, secondly, an implacable unreasonableness and enmity in our heart. We have, besides this iniquity and deformity in us, we have an implacable unreasonableness of enmity in our heart that's also without comparison in any object that's ever been loved. You see, Romans 8 says, about ourselves in our natural, in our nature. And this was, like I said this morning, this is where your child is until they're regenerated. This is where you are until you're birthed. This is why your child bends and tends away when they get a certain age, as I've been trying to say in the morning. They have this until there's regeneration. It says it this way. The mind set on the flesh is death, but the mind set on the spirit is life and peace. Because the mind set on the flesh is hostile to God. Does not subject itself to the law of God. It's not even able to do so. There's a hostility. There's an implacable enmity in the heart against God. There's a prejudice in the heart against God. There's a biased, an unjust, unfair prejudice against his being. There's no ability to see any good in him, and it's all unfair and it's all unjust. He's caricatured the wrong way. He's pictured the wrong in the sinner's heart. He's never seen as something that's delightful. He even though he's all of this. He's an ogre and a robber of happiness. He's all these things. And you can't take that out of a sinner's heart. You can't talk it out of their heart. They don't believe it. You can't reason that out of them. It's impossible. He's a hater and despiser of God. And when Christ came in the flesh, who was himself eternal God in a body, representatively, they said, crucify him on our behalf. And the whole community knew he'd never done anything wrong. They knew that. They knew all he ever did was good. They knew that. That was how he was known. And they didn't care. made their sinful lives very uncomfortable. Heal my body, then get out of town. Heal my loved ones, and then leave the city. You're making me uncomfortable. I've got a woman on the side, and you make me feel uneasy. I'm plotting a sin, and with you around, it's bothering me. Get out of town. Heal my kids. Give me that fish and the loaves, and then please leave. You saw that when he healed the demoniac of Gadara. But then the pigs, the swine were embodied by those demons, and they ran off the cliff, and they said, would you please leave our city, Jesus? Remember that? Please leave our city. We're losing money with you around. Wait a minute. He healed the worst person in your city. Well, get out of our city. See, there's this implacable, unreasonable enmity in the heart against God. Negatively, if you think about it, God's never done anyone any wrong. If he did create the sun and the moon and gave you the sunshine, he's done you good. When you lay out in the backyard and you work in the garden and you feel his sun, he did you good. Here's what's interesting. When bad things happen, we blame God. We never thank God for the good things. A sinner never says, I'm glad the sun's shining today. Let's go to the lake and have a good day on the water and in the sun that God made. No, it doesn't happen. But when there's a tragedy at the lake, look what God did. How can he let that happen? What enmity in the heart? Proverbs says it like this. Foolishness subverts or ruins a man's way. Foolishness ruins a man's way. And then his heart rages against the Lord. Wow. So there's an implacable, unreasonable enmity in the heart of the one that he loved. And yet his love was set upon them. Fixated. Never to be conquered. Never to be subdued. Never to be stopped. That's appealing. I'd like to meet that person. Wouldn't you? I'd love to meet someone like that, who's also glorious and infinite. But more than that, it's not just that he's done no wrong and he's done good, but it's not recognized, and only the bad thing is impugned against him, even though our foolishness and our rebellion is often what subverts it, and our ultimate sin is what brought the chaos and the curse. He's found fault with. There's such enmity in the heart. But there's a loveliness. His loveliness of nature, not merely what he does. And the loveliness of his being is rejected, even though there's a dying love. And the love towards sinners goes to the point of dying. It's spurned and it doesn't change them. They're not moved. They're not touched. And droves and thousands of people grow up in church, hear it, and leave to never go back. Unmoved. Unmoved. What an unparalleled love that he goes after him. He goes after him. He was despised and forsaken of men, wasn't he? He was smitten of God. But let's look lastly at the infinite degree of the strength of which he demonstrated his love is without comparison. The degree of the strength of which he demonstrated his love is without comparison. There's no way to compare it. You know, we're told to love in word and deed. First John said, well, God proclaims his love for us in the gospel, but he proved his love for us by deed. Now, you can start with the fact that he stooped. He's infinite. He's eternal without a beginning. He's sufficient and contented, lacking nothing to make him happy. And he left heaven and took on the form of a man and became a man, and so that he became the God-man, for he remained entirely himself when he became a man. And we could go there. But the ultimate manifestation, of course, of this degree of the strength of his love, which has no parallel, is the fact of the suffering and sacrifice on the objects of his loves, who were infinitely in deformity and rebellion on the behalf of the objects of his love. Now, if someone gives a lot of money to someone or bestows good things upon them, but there's no cost, there's no real cost to it, no sacrifice to it, that's not as significant as when there's suffering and cost. And I'm not belittling, for example, what Bill Gates does and the money he gives away, the $100 million I think he gave to fight AIDS in India and in Africa. But we all know that that's not even a percent of a percent of what he's worth. It's to be commended, but it simply doesn't compare when there's cost. And you can see the strength with which he loved in his refusing to allow the nature of his sufferings to overcome it and bring it to an end. When you think of the cruel, lingering, tormenting death, that should have brought his love to an end and overcome it, as it were, and swallowed it and buried it, or whatever you want to call it, especially since the objects were so unworthy and had nothing to do with drawing it out of him. Look at Luke 22 and notice this is the significance of Gethsemane. He came out and proceeded, as was his custom, in verse 39, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples also followed him. When he arrived at the place, he said to them, "Pray that you may not enter temptation." He withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and began to pray. Fell down, literally. I think in Mark, "Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me, yet not my will but yours be done." An angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. And being in agony, he was praying very fervently. His sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground. You know, when there's great anxiety, you sweat. Palm sweat, forehead sweat. The pressure from within of the anxiety pushes and creates a response on the sweat glands. In rare, rare occasions, it causes the blood to coagulate and come through the veins. The extremity of the pressure. Now, what was this about? The sufferings that he was about to undergo were anticipated. They had been planned before the foundation of the world. Remember, he was a lamb slain from the foundation of the world. When he came into the world, he knew that it was designed to absorb a punishment that we deserved. He knew that. And it entailed not a mere cruelty of man. It entailed, at the apex of it, being the focal point of the anger, the just anger, the reasonable anger, the righteous anger of God upon him. A fury, the Bible calls it, that's just and reasonable. And he knew this. And so, in the garden, he's staring at it. It's imminent. Now, what rose up in him to enable him to not be overcome with it? The strength of the love with which he loved those for which he would do it. It couldn't be overcome. Dear Christian, do you realize how he loves you? Do you have any comprehension of this? That's what wouldn't be quenched. The strength of his love was greater than the fury unleashed upon him in suffering. At any point, he could have just said, "That's it." So you have this cruel, lingering, tormenting death, which he anticipated since it was planned. But the terror of facing it, now remember, he's only facing it right here in the garden. The terror of facing it couldn't overcome him. It couldn't diminish the strength of his love. There is no love like Jesus' love for His people. There's nothing like it. For His bride, for His sheep, there's nothing like it. In all eternity. This terror of staring, not at the mere crucifixion. Many men had been crucified, but the terror of that. The terror of what precipitated it, the horrible scourgings, the mockings, the scourgings that were beyond any that probably they ever inflicted, because the very venting of the devil himself came out on him. Because the devil knew who he was. It wasn't merely that. It was the final apex on that cross when he's not merely suffering physically, but the Father abandons him. He abandons him so that he's really in hell. Because hell is abandonment. Listen to me. It's abandonment. And it's darkness and it's forever. This is why Edward says, the troubles and sorrows of his soul were as such of the nature of the torments of hell as an innocent, holy person were capable of experiencing. What kept him there? Why was he there? There was the strength of a love that couldn't be diminished. Oh, I can't wait to see him. I know he loves me. And he loves me. But he happens to be the sovereign of the universe that loved a worm. And then you can go one last step on this that shows it's incomparable. Is the incomparable benefits of his love. You know, when you love someone, it's to benefit them. Right? It's to benefit them. He absorbed God's wrath so that he purchased pardon and acceptance forever. And we're declared righteous and justified as we're clothed with his righteousness in a moment. But more than that, he brought us into sonship, whereby we cry, Abba, Father, and we are adult sons. It's like Spurgeon said, when God saved us, since we were criminals and malefactors against his glory, he could have put us in a remote planet on the edge of the universe, and it would have been good enough. We'd have been happy. But he didn't. He made us adult sons who will share the glory with his son. There's never been love like this. There's just, it can't be compared to anything. And of course, that's what the supper's about, isn't it? That's what the table's about. We take the cup, we take the juice, and these are the wedding band and the necklace of the groom. Right? That's what they are. They're symbols to remind us of his love. Do this as often as you do it, what? In remembrance of me. For as often as you eat and as often as you drink it, you what? Proclaim the Lord's death. What about his death? The undying love of it for me. What else? The absorbing of the judgment of God and the wrath of God that I deserve for all my deformities, all my perversities, all my sins, all my ingratitudes, that would justly, fairly condemn me. Fairly condemn me. Undying, unparalleled love. Well, I'm going to pray. When I pray, can we have the men come on up front? While I'm praying. Father, how is it possible to relate this adequately apart from the Spirit who speaks to us inwardly and pierces us for our sin, if we're here tonight in sin, and where we just put our chin on our chest and say, God, I can't look up at you. I'm a sinner. Or if we're discouraged, we lift up our chin and say, oh, God is for me. Who can be against me? So, Lord, help us to worship you and your Son in the supper. Help us to adore you in the supper. Help us to give you the praise, and we'll thank you in Jesus' name.